the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خَلَقَ السماوات والأرض في ستة أيام ثم استوى على العرش يغشي الليل النهار يطلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين.
of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly, and He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories: a new domestically made destroyer and a new minesweeper joined the Iranian Navy in a Persian Gulf port. Palestinians react to the election of Naftali Bennett as the new Israeli prime minister, saying Israel is a colonial entity and that their demands remain the same. Also ahead, a fire at a Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of the Indian capital has left hundreds of people homeless. We'll have a report from Delhi. Greetings, everyone. My name is Arash Zahedi. Welcome. The Iranian Navy has unveiled a new domestically made destroyer and a new minesweeper in the southern port of Bandar Abbas. The destroyer, named Dena, is the fourth of Jamaran-class frigates and is fitted with Iran's different defensive and offensive systems. It is capable of sailing long distances in open water. The warship has a flight deck for helicopters and can detect, counter, or destroy aerial and marine threats. Iran also inducted the Shaheen Mine Countermeasure Vessel into the Navy in the same ceremony. The fully indigenous vessel uses the world's latest technologies to detect and neutralize sea mines. A senior Iranian diplomat has lashed out at the new U.S. administration for refusing to remove sanctions against Iran. Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said in a tweet that the Joe Biden administration has contributed to these, quote, crimes against humanity since it took office months ago. Araghchi underlined Washington has targeted Iranians with cruel and illegal sanctions for nearly 3 years now. Its comments come as the new U.S. administration has so far failed to remove the sanctions imposed on Iran by former U.S. President Donald Trump. Washington has even refused to ease restrictions on the import of medical equipment and medicine at a time when Iran is struggling to control the COVID-19 outbreak. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier says the U.S. wants to return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal without removing the unlawful sanctions that former President Donald Trump imposed on the country.
the Americans are trying to gain without the return of to the JCPOA and without lifting the illegal, unlawful sanctions that is recognized by the United Nations, that sanctioning populations, preventing them from having medical access to medical facilities and the medicine and to their right and their assets that are frozen abroad, is a violation of the international law. And I don't think Joe Biden is serious enough to lift all the sanctions imposed since 2015, 2017, until the departure of Donald Trump. And today we have another president who is saying, I am the humanitarian president and I'm here to make the world a better place, but he's keeping the sanction. He has done nothing in Syria, he has done nothing in Yemen, and he is only following the step of the U.S. administration. The U.S. administration changes the president, changes slightly the behavior of the president, but at the end of the day, the policy is the same, imposing hegemony and control over other countries. That has been the policy of the United States in decades.
Palestinian officials have reacted to the election of Naftali Bennett as the new Israeli prime minister, emphasizing that the change will not affect their stance toward Israel. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said, regardless of the shape and color of the new administration, Israel remains a colonial and occupation entity. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhum said Palestinians will resist by force to get their rights back. A spokesman for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas also emphasized that the changes will not alter Palestine's position, which has always been a Palestinian state. On the 1967 borders with Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital, the reactions came after the Israeli parliament voted in favor of a new coalition cabinet, ending Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year tenure as prime minister. Now, right-wing Naftali Bennett will lead the new cabinet for 2 years before his centrist ally, Yair Lapid, takes over. Human rights activist and political commentator Firas Najim says Palestinians are unmoved with the Israeli change of cabinet and will remain united to defend their rights.
The Zionist regime is going to continue to do the same thing that they've always done, just different people, different faces, different ways of doing it. And, you know, Hamas has to deal with the situation, right? Right now, they're still continuing to steal people's homes, you know, in Sheikh Jarrah or in other places. Now, there's another dangerous area that they're also planning right now to attack and take people out of their homes. So it's a dangerous situation. Escalations at any time can happen. The Palestinian people are unified. That's the good thing about it now, is that they know if the Israelis are going to attack Jerusalem, that Gaza's not going to sit by and stand by and, you know, watch Jerusalem, you know, just be, you know, aggressed against and people getting killed and not doing nothing about it. So they know now the Palestinians are more unified than ever before.
Latest Israeli onslaught on the Gaza Strip has already come to an end, but its tragic humanitarian aspects continue to unfold further day by day. Ruba Shabit has filed this report on the suffering of a Palestinian man who has lost his family in an Israeli airstrike. Here's more.
Mohammed Al-Attar, a Palestinian teacher, has lost his wife and three children in an Israeli airstrike in his house in North Gaza Strip. Mohammed's four-story building that was a shelter for his entire family totally collapsed to the ground. Mohammed, who used to have a normal life working at a school and looking after his kids, is now homeless and without a family.
Israeli airstrikes hit our building without any prior notice. I just opened my eyes and found all of us under the rubble. Some of us managed to get out of the rubble. I tried to save my children, but to no avail. I called for help from Civil Defense Service, but it took long till they reached us. I just want to ask the international community and human rights groups, what are our rights? I had a peaceful life and suddenly I became homeless without a family. I lost every hope I used to have.
Hassan al-Attar, Mohammed's father-in-law, has his own sufferings to tell. Working in the civil defense services, he was surprised with a call informing that his daughter, along with her three kids, were killed by Israeli airstrikes. Staring at the bodies of his daughter and her three children, Hassan bid farewell to his daughter while he was at work trying to pull their bodies from the rubbles.
I was at work when Mohammed called me to tell that Israel bombed his house and my daughter and her three kids were under the rubbles. They weren't ambulances. They were all out on missions and I had to wait for them on. When I got to them, their bodies were all out of the rubbles. I don't know why Israel targeted them.
Most Gazans are in need of mental health support following the latest 11-day escalation that killed families in their homes in Gaza. The north parts of the Gaza Strip, along with Beit Hanun and Jabalia, was one of the areas that witnessed bombardment coupled with heavy artillery shelling.
Since the first day of this escalation, we all have been grappling with hard psychological conditions. Three of my grandchildren were killed and the rest were injured. Even the ones that survived really need mental health care. I still remember when they hit our building and we tried to pull each other from the rubbles. This is a war that I will never forget it.
Hundreds of Palestinians, including women and children, were killed in the Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip in 11 days of the conflict that began on May 10. Israel's airstrikes also brought widespread devastation to the already impoverished territory.
Palestinians here say the aggression has not undermined their will to stand against the occupation regime. They say despite their suffering, they will remain steadfast and fight for their rights. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
A destructive fire has engulfed a Rohingya refugee camp in the outskirts of New Delhi. As Munawar Zaman reports, hundreds are rendered homeless with nothing more than their lives intact.
Ashes and rubbles. There is nothing more left as despair has once again taken over Rohingya refugees in New Delhi. A devastating fire has brought down the entire camp to ruins. Around 55 families were residing in the camp. Most of the refugees have escaped unharmed, but all they had has turned into ashes. Now some local NGOs and residents are lending support.
It was around 11:30 in the night yesterday when my children started crying due to the heat of the fire. When I opened my eyes, there was huge smoke and fire. We immediately got out of our shanty and moved to the safety.
The residents of the camp are not sure how the fire started, but an eyewitness said it started in the middle of the camp, and within an hour, everything was on ground, and it took the firefighters a lot of efforts to control it. Rights activists have urged the UN Refugee Agency for prompt response in helping them with every possible way.
I don't know why we are facing all this hardship. Our lives are miserable. We can't live in our own country with dignity. And wherever we go for refuge, hardship follows us. I'm happy to have my child alive. I can't forget the scene I saw yesterday. Even if I close my eyes, it frightens me.
The camp is surrounded by a cluster of shanties where people from all faiths live. Many people I spoke with had a suspicion that either the fire broke out due to a short circuit or it could possibly be a conspiracy to vacate them from the location, since the deportation campaign to expel Rohingya from India has gained momentum in recent years. The blaze has destroyed everything these people have had. Now they have to brave both the harsh heat of the summer and the fear of the COVID-19 pandemic. Their miseries continue to mount with each passing day. In a display of mercy and compassion, scores of neighboring residents and activists from the NGOs reached the spot to lend whatever help they could. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in India who are now stuck in limbo amid a vicious campaign to deport them. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
India is witnessing a gradual decline in its daily coronavirus cases. The health ministry has reported over 70,000 new infections in the last 24 hours. That is the lowest since early February. The new figure has pushed India's total caseload to over 29.5 million. The South Asian nation also registered nearly 4,000 new COVID-related fatalities overnight, raising the overall death toll to more than 374,000. India is battling with a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic. Strict lockdowns and mass vaccine rollouts have helped it contain the virus surge. Over 156 million people have already been vaccinated there, but the country still remains the second worst affected in the whole world after the U.S. in terms of infections and third in terms of deaths after Brazil. To a different story now, the Russian president says he expects the upcoming summit with his U.S. counterpart to restore personal contacts and establish dialogue on issues of mutual interest.
It seems to me that the summit will help restore our contacts, relations, establish a direct dialogue, and create a functioning mechanism for action in those areas that are of mutual interest.
Vladimir Putin noted that Joe Biden shared his views about engaging in negotiations. Putin also said Moscow would be ready for prisoner swap if Washington agrees. The two presidents are set to meet on June the 16th in Geneva for a summit amid strained bilateral relations between the countries on a wide array of issues. Washington says Biden will bring up ransomware cyber attacks reportedly emanating from Russia at the summit, which has been one of the most recent sources of tension between the two sides. Members of the Islamic movement of Nigeria have renewed their call for the release of their leader, Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, who has been in detention for over 2,000 days. Danjuma Abdullahi is in Abuja.
To mark the 2,000 days of the detention of Sheikh Zakzaki, the Islamic movement in Nigeria issued a statement expressing concern over the continuous detention of the Islamic cleric, but most especially the silence of other Nigerians over this injustice. In December 2015, Sheikh Zakzaki was arrested by security forces following an attack on his home and worship center, where hundreds of his supporters were killed by soldiers. The statement by the Islamic movement said the silence of those who are supposed to condemn the injustice is more painful than the jubilation of the oppressors.
The masses should know that if today is Sheikh Zakzaki, tomorrow it may be you. If you are a Christian and the government is detaining the Sheikh, well, you want to kill the Sheikh because he doesn't practice the same ideology in Islam with them, what about you that you are a Christian? You should come out and join hand and fight against injustice and say no to injustice and oppression.
For over 5 years, members of the Islamic movement have been coming out to protest, seeking for the release of Sheikh Zakzaki, but the Nigerian government has kept a deaf ear. Over 300 supporters of Sheikh Zakzaki were killed and dumped in a mass grave without proper identification and funeral prayers. This and the attack on Sheikh Zakzaki and his supporters, according to the Islamic movement, were despicable and unacceptable.
That is the worst that has happened in the history of Africa, where a detachment of army of a country, we launch an attack to an innocent citizen, to his house, is the worst crime against humanity in the history of Africa.
Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zakzaki is spending close to 6 years in detention. The Islamic movement in Nigeria called on the Nigerian authorities to comply with the Federal High Court order and release Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife Zainab. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
And that's it with international news.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makes the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sin.
2018's presidential election. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on Friday, 18th of June. Participation of different candidates in the scene of elections and participation of people from all walks of life is a source of pride for the Islamic Republic of Iran. Asadullah Badamchian, a famous political figure, says on political parties in Iran, "A party that believes in God examines different people to find the best and most righteous person for responsibilities. Then it announces it to the public. Thus, a real Islamic party seeks to introduce the most proper person, the most qualified person for every responsibility, even if he is not a member of the party." Badamchian reiterated that this culture has usually caused his party to move in the course of values of Islamic revolution. He added, "My party believes that it should take part in the elections whilst preserving unity and respecting all other inclinations. Everyone can come to the scene. My party will not oppose those who come to the scene because this is the legal right of everyone." Analyst Asadullah Badamchian, referring to the qualification or disqualification of the nominees, which is constitutionally undertaken by the Guardian Council, stresses that if we have 50 candidates, there is no problem for them to introduce themselves to the people. It is the duty of political parties and their leaders to choose the most suitable and the most qualified person. As for maximum usage of all capacities, he maintains that competition among different views is quite natural. But it is our religious duty to reach a consensus. It is our religious, national, and political duty to find the best candidate for president. Dear listeners, although the principalist and reformist currents have been the two famous political currents for the past two decades, people have not paid attention to their names, as Iranians are not that affected by partisan politics and show-offs. What is important for people is the performance of currents and groups. Although at times these groups and currents have succeeded to deceive people and garner their votes for their own vested interests. Today's urgent need is for the eradication of poverty, unemployment, reduction of discrimination, and removal of corruption. And it has been pointed out several times by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the priority of any government that comes to power is to address the challenges and the issues facing the people, seriously affecting their livelihood. Solving the problems faced by ordinary people, the livelihood problems of people, requires using all capacities in the best way and removing all obstacles in the way of production and manufacturing, in a bid to support industrialists and farmers in a healthy, competitive climate. This will lead to a better economy and pave the way for an economic leap. According to various studies, inflation, unemployment, and other economic factors mainly stem from mismanagement and incompetent managers. This has caused different goods to reach people's hands at very high prices, so that in many cases people prefer not to buy even necessary items. Azad Armaki, researcher of social issues, says, "In such conditions, social forces often stand in the first line to clarify the needs and requirements of society. Then these needs are crystallized in the form of political demands. and after that political forces emerge, and finally, a person is elected to the office of the president and wins the election. Researcher of social issues, Azad Armaki, believes that the duality of opponent-proponent is formed before the election, and society enters the scene for political activity.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, this is Mehdi and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about the lives of Rohingya people in Myanmar against the backdrop of the crippling pandemic as well as a military coup. And we shall take a look at the economic growth in Bangladesh and its prospective climb up the ladder of global trade and Asian geopolitics.
While Rohingya people are being relocated to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal, prone to floods and cyclones, life is getting harder and harder for this Muslim minority community due to the deadly pandemic in their camps, as well as fires and violent Buddhist extremists rampaging their lives. Condemning the relocation, the United Nations and other rights groups have expressed concerns about the safety of the persecuted refugees, as well as their volition. Authorities say they only send those who have volunteered, but the Rohingya say they are being coerced.
Back in the time when the whole subcontinent was one entity under the British colonial rules, a lot of people used to move back and forth throughout the whole region without restrictions. But the World War II messed up the situation. The Rohingya were allied with the British and wanted their areas to be part of Bangladesh, then called East Pakistan. But Burma had an alliance with the Japanese invaders, hoping to topple the British rule. Thus were born the roots of the enmity. When the Burmese won the war and gained independence, they wanted to get rid of the Rohingyas since they saw them as illegal Bangladeshi immigrants in their country, or the remnants of its British colonial past. More than 130 distinct ethnic groups live in Myanmar, with the largest minorities having their own states under the Panglong Agreement in 1947. But the Rohingyas, even at over a million in population then, were not recognized, and they have been denied citizenship since the country's independence. To make it impossible for the Rohingyas to live there, Myanmar created a legal vicious circle. Under the country's citizenship law of 1982, only members of ethnic groups that settled within Myanmar prior to 1823 are eligible for automatic citizenship. And if they have descendants that enter the country before 1948, they can apply for naturalization if they can submit evidence and documentation. But most of the Rohingyas, who have been living in the area for centuries, don't have the proper paperwork because the country didn't allow them to.
The complex Rohingya refugee crisis aggravated in August 2017 following some small-scale attacks on remote police outposts in western Myanmar by armed groups allegedly belonging to the community. This was a pretext for the following systematic assaults against the Muslim minority, which human rights groups, including senior UN officials, have said amounted to ethnic cleansing. More than 700,000 Rohingyas escaped the genocide by Myanmar's military with little more than the clothes on their backs and joined 300,000 people already in camps in Bangladesh in 2017. Attempts at repatriation of the Rohingyas to Myanmar have failed because these stateless people, who have seen their villages burnt and wives raped by the Buddhist extremists and the military, were too fearful of further violence to return.
The COVID-19 pandemic has added to the miseries of the persecuted community. Due to lockdowns, most of these people have lost their jobs, forcing them to live on charity while hunger and poverty loom over the community. In recent weeks, dozens of Rohingyas, including children, developed COVID-like symptoms, but their camps lack testing facilities, and the community is not eligible to apply for vaccine since they are described as illegal immigrants. The spread of the virus is unavoidable in the camps because their makeshift shanties lean on each other and there is absolutely no support programs for food, sanitation or health care. As the virus keeps raging across the camps, they had to resort to home remedies and self-quarantine, but the destitute minority is getting closer to another humanitarian disaster if they don't get access to medicine and vaccine.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Ali Johar, co-director of Rohingya Human Rights Initiative. First of all, I would like to thank Mr. Johar for being on the program and ask him to walk us through the crisis that has plagued the Rohingya Muslims for decades and why they are persecuted.
Thank you so much for having me here. Actually, this question is should be for the persecutors, not to the persecuted. But what I can explain to you is what actually has been happening with the Rohingyas since decades. So from the beginning, I may start from 1942 when, around 200,000 Rohingyas had to flee the country in a first, violent attack. And then in 1975, 15,000 Rohingya had to flee. In 1977, an operation called Operation Nagema, which is clearly a racial, attacks on the minorities. So this attack was, by the military to clear the so-called foreign nationals. In 1978, another military operation led to 200,000 Rohingya Muslim flee from their homelands. In 1982, military amended the constitution that talks about three categorical citizenship, where one is for the indigenous people, other one is for the naturalized, another one is for the descendants of the mixed population. So in this indigenous category, Rohingyas have been excluded since then. No Rohingyas have been allowed to hold any public offices. In 1990, NLD won the general election, which was clearly ignored by the military. And in 1991, again, more than 200,000, around 250,000 Rohingyas had to flee because of they were used as forced labor. Our women have been used as sex slaves by the military and raped, and because of the religious persecution as well. In between 2004 to 1997 to 2004, around 230,000 refugees were repatriated under a deal by United Nations. But this kind of violent attack continuously took place since military started its dictatorship, which has ended up in a very most horrific experience of the Rohingya in their lifetime in 2016 and 17, leading more than 750,000 people fleeing to Bangladesh, joining Exodus there. You know, it's been reported that almost 10,000 women have been raped, you know, thousands have been killed.
How has the situation changed since the coup d'etat in Myanmar, and is life any different for the Rohingyas who control the country?
You know, Rohingya have been facing decade-long persecution under the military rule. Whoever rules the country, the minorities have been, you know, at the end of receiving the violent crackdown. Since the coup took place, all the attention was on the, you know, rehabilitating the genocide survivors, that is Rohingyas. But after the coup took place, this entire world attention have been shifted to, towards human rights violation in the larger picture. So the process that have been initiated to rehabilitate the Rohingyas to actually go back to their homelands, and the Rohingyas who are hopeful to, you know, return to their homes very soon have become, you know, a delayed process. So as we were already in a confined situation, the coup has brought, you know, more worse situation for us, because it is the military which has been, you know, persecuting us, and it is again the military, same military government there now. So the coup has, you know, brought a devastation for Rohingyas. But there is a change in the, you know, general public minds, because the military has, you know, manipulated the situation of Rohingyas by misinforming the general public that it is because of the Rohingyas, you know, it is themselves they are creating the situation in Rakhine State. You know, the military does playing with the rule of law, but now the general public is realizing that they have been misinformed, that the general public has been, you know, used as a campaign against the Rohingyas. So now there is a shift in the understanding of the general public that we were actually misinformed. In fact, you know, we were used in the persecution of the Rohingya Muslims.
Thank you, Mr. Johar, for being on the program. And now let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Remove the Fence has portrayed a grim but normal scene in the lives of kids from the minority community. RYMGMGSA has pointed out one of the particular problems of living in camps. Rain is no longer a blessing when you have no roof. Rohingya Girls Matter has touched upon yet another ugly truth about their ordeal, an hour-long line for a sip of water. Taqiya Azam has talked about the situation of coronavirus spread across their refugee camp. Zia Nang tells the story of a Rohingya man who has been tortured by Myanmar's military. He is Rohingya refugee living in Bangladesh camps.
Put hand pollution and what a little gift and this country people is Rohingya. Coming to Bangladesh, Balukali camp 11, 15, because and family very, very dangerous. serious son and family, and no rights, no quality, no water, no relief, no money in gift, and very dangerous, very, very problem. But no, they were cancelled.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Since the COVID pandemic has hit the world, the economies of many countries have contracted significantly. But an Asian country, not known for its economic resilience, is doing surprisingly well. Emerging as a new rising star, Bangladesh even managed to leave India and Pakistan behind in terms of per capita income. Moreover, the country is now amongst those countries that helped India in the devastating new wave of the COVID pandemic.
As one of the emerging economies of South Asia, Bangladesh has seen significant economic growth during the past decades and is seemingly set to become the next economic superstar in Asia. With nearly 10% rise in per capita income for the year 2020 to 2021, Bangladesh has surpassed India and Pakistan with an estimated $2,227. As a result of higher than expected remittance flows, the World Bank has revised Bangladesh's GDP growth from an earlier prediction of 1.7% to 3.6%. When Bangladesh announced its independence from Pakistan in early 1970s, the newborn state was struggling with war, famine, and mass exodus. A large number of Bangladeshi people were killed on their way to Pakistan and India that were the richer and stronger countries back then. But now the landscape of the country seems far more prosperous than the rest of the countries in the subcontinent. Now it is Bangladesh that is helping others. Bangladesh has agreed to provide a currency swap of $200 million to Sri Lanka for a period of 3 months. Moreover, Bangladesh is also amongst the 40 states which provided assistance to India during the devastating second wave of the pandemic. The South Asian nation provided India with over 10,000 vials of remdesivir, as well as PPE kits, zinc, calcium, vitamin C, and other tablets. Once believed to be so destitute that illegal migrants from there kept overrunning the neighboring borders, Bangladesh is now way happier and richer than most of the countries of the subcontinent.
Back in the 70s, some believed that the new country seemed destined to fail. Henry Kissinger, then Secretary of State, famously called it a basket case. However, recent developments proved otherwise, as the growing importance of Bangladesh is not just limited to the context of South Asia, but the whole world. In addition to remittance flow, a large portion of Bangladesh's GDP is from the garment industry, with overcrowded factories and substandard conditions. If Bangladesh seeks to sustain its growth and become an economic powerhouse, it should recognize and address its vulnerabilities.
Upon creation, Bangladesh started its economic trail with implementation of socialist policies and nationalized the majority of its corporations. It was not the right way and decreased industrial production near to zero. Therefore, the government gradually revised the policies and returned state-owned enterprises to the private sector. The reforms raised the contribution of industrial sector to the GDP, thus accelerating the growth in industrial and service sectors. With a massive labor force that is among the top 10 across the globe, today Bangladesh is one of the largest garment manufacturers of the world. The sector accounts for over 84% of the country's total exports and provides employment to more than 4 million workers. In addition, the country's service sector is now the largest contributor to their GDP and employment. Another factor behind the growth is the remittance by the diaspora. In 2019, about 10 million Bangladeshi migrants sent home over $18 billion. This is nearly 7% of the total GDP of the nation and has created a steady flow of foreign currency to the country. To keep up the growth, Bangladesh faces numerous challenges too. The manufacturing is not properly diversified, and depending so much on one single industry can have its own caveats. Despite the growth, Bangladesh witnessed a 20% decrease in foreign direct investment last year, and over-dependence on remittance can adversely affect the domestic production.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Dr. Ahsan Mansoor, Executive Director of Policy Research Institute of Bangladesh and Chairman of BRAC Bank. Now, Mr. Ahsan, welcome to the show. During the COVID pandemic, the economies of many countries have contracted. How come Bangladesh's economy did not shrink?
Well, that's a very good question, because we think that the economy expanded, it didn't shrink, but it slowed down quite a bit. We are growing at 7% plus rate, so it came down significantly because of COVID. Primarily, our several sectors was not much impacted. Agriculture was completely outside the COVID, so, and they had a very good output. So agriculture sector was completely intact and growing. Other than the urban centers, most of the rural area was untouched. For all practical purposes, there was not much of an impact there of the COVID. So urban centers were shut out, and that. And so industries were impacted, but they recovered. The large industries recovered very fast. In fact, many of them did not, even the bank that I am chairing, we didn't have any big loss or anything. Our profitability was the same as before. So it shows that it's an indication that the economy was pretty robust in many ways. So I think agriculture plus large industries coming back very fast, the small ones have been impacted significantly. And some of the service sector activities were impacted initially, but then they rebounded very fast because construction and other small service sectors, including this, that, they recovered very fast. So overall, growth slowed down, but it was not negative.
How did Bangladesh manage to leave India and Pakistan behind in per capita income, and what are some of the factors behind this growth?
Okay, yeah. You see, Bangladesh has been growing very steadily in the last 30, 40 years. In the 80s, our growth rate was 3%. In the 90s, it was 4%. In the 2000, it was 5%. And then in 2000, it was 6%. And then it was 7%. And then it touched 8%, but it didn't sustain because of COVID. So that's one part of it. Why it is growing steadily is in part because of, we do invest a respectable amount, about 30% of GDP is investment every year in the economy. That's a sizable amount. Plus, we have a real strong macroeconomic stability. We never had very large fluctuations in the exchange rates and so on, unlike Pakistan, India, and many other emerging countries, middle income countries. So our exchange rate is very stable. And compared to India, our exchange rate in the last two decades probably appreciated by about 40%. 50% our currency vis-a-vis India. And vis-a-vis Pakistan, our currency is appreciated by more than 100%. So, and that exchange rate factor is plays a role in the dollar conversion to comparison purpose. So Indian per capita income didn't grow as much because of the currency depreciation than Bangladesh, Bangladesh stability and so on. And we also have a stable inflation, about 5% or so. So So everything taken together, it's a good environment, macro environment. Balance of payment has always been very strong, and our reserve position is very strong. We have, for our needs, we have $45 billion, which is our 10 months of import cover for us. And it's growing. So overall, the whole macro environment has a steady growth. And you see, in the IMF estimate, Bangladesh came out to be one of the two countries which is most stable in terms of economic growth and macro stability. So I don't know which was the other one. So that speaks for itself. And that's if you continue that policy for decades, it gives you result.
Thank you, Mr. Mansour, for your precious time. Now let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Umar has hailed Bangladesh for its growing economy, noting that extending $1 million loan to Sri Lanka is a definite proof that Bangladesh is going up the global economic ladder. Srivatsa has drawn a chart to emphasize on some comparisons between India and Bangladesh. He underlines that Bangladesh is helping India in handling COVID, and then made fun of Modi's motto of progress, or Vikas in Sanskrit. Kanane Irrespon has used the news of Bangladesh's growth in per capita income as an opportunity to lambast the performance of Modi's government. Kanika Agarwal reiterates the fact that Bangladesh is now richer than Pakistan and India, and asks everyone to take a moment to digest this.
And that was our special episode on the looming humanitarian disaster awaiting the Rohingya Muslim community on the backdrop of the COVID-19 pandemic. Thank you. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
The Limelight.
Global leaders that are big in Cornwall for the G7 summit have already found themselves in a changed world. Face masks and social distancing have replaced the usual hugs, handshakes, and cheek pecking. The entourages have slimmed down, and the usual media circus has been muted, with protesters having to contend themselves with writing sand messages on the beach. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, G7 Leaders Face Make or Break Moment in Climate Crisis. Stay with us for more of Fiona Harvey's article. Global leaders arriving in Cornwall for the G7 summit have already found themselves in a changed world. Face masks and social distancing have replaced the usual hugs, handshakes, and cheek pecking. The entourages have slimmed down, and the usual media circus has been muted, with protesters having to contend themselves with writing sand messages on the beach. Boris Johnson has faced ridicule and accusations of hypocrisy for travelling to Carbis Bay by private jet. Some of the other leaders have been more concerned about the extent to which quarantine rules apply to them. But amid the ever-present reminders that 2021 is a year unlike any other, one of the biggest changes will be entirely invisible. Carbon dioxide is now at a higher level in the atmosphere than at any point in the last 4 million years, newly released data has shown. The world has entered uncharted territory where global heating is concerned, and greenhouse gas emissions are rising strongly still. The message could not be clearer. If the world fails to act now, the future will be changed beyond anything the coronavirus pandemic has brought about. Lord Stern, the climate economist, said, "This is a crucial moment in history. Either we recover from the pandemic in a strong and sustainable way, or we don't. We are at a real fork in the road. This decade is decisive." Scientists have made it clear that greenhouse gas emissions must be halved by 2030 if the world is to stay within 1.5 degrees Celsius of global heating, the threshold beyond which extreme weather will take hold. Small islands and low-lying areas will face inundation, and swathes of the world will face water stress and heat waves. Stern pointed to the checkered progress of the past 10 years, in which the cost of renewable energy has plunged and technology such as electric vehicles has increased, but in which progress on cutting emissions overall has been painfully slow. The last decade was not very good, and this next decade could be just as bad or even worse if we make the wrong choices, he said. G7 countries are responding, all of the leaders coming to Cornwall, from United States, United Kingdom, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, and the European Union, have affirmed their commitment to holding temperature rises to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, the lower limit set out in the 2015 Paris Agreement. All have long-term targets to reach net zero emissions by 2050, and nearly all have targets to cut carbon in the next decade. The United Kingdom has led with the goal of cutting emissions by 68% by 2030 and by 78% by 2035, based on 1990 levels. The United States will halve emissions by 2030 based on 2005 levels, and the European Union will make cuts by at least 55% by 2030.